Hello and welcome into the KE Report. I'm your host, Shad Markowitz, and I'm speaking today with John Rubino, founder of the Dollar Collapse website. And we'll have a link to that, dollarcollapse.com, down below this interview. John, it's always great getting you on the show just to get your take on the world around us, whether it's the financial markets, the economy, the health of the world. We're seeing a lot of turmoil out there. And one of the areas that we have talked about in the past that seems to be rearing its head again is the effects that high food and energy prices would have on global stability. If people recall, throughout history, one of the things that sends nations into chaos faster than anything is when you have high food prices. So if you couple that with high energy prices, it's really putting a squeeze on a lot of the emerging markets. You had mentioned a survey to me off mic that I'd love you to share with our audience that just discusses kind of the lay of the land on the global stage.
Hey, Shad. Well, yeah, the general theme of what's going on now is that inflation, especially food and energy inflation, are an annoyance for people in the US and Canada. You know, it makes life harder, but it doesn't force you to decide whether to feed your kids or drive to work. You know, you can still do all the basic stuff you need to do. But in other parts of the world, that's not the case. You know, people who are just getting by in Argentina or Zimbabwe or someplace like that, and they're food costs double and their gas goes up by 50% or whatever, all of a sudden that's an existential threat. And people tend to take to the streets in emerging markets when that happens. And there was just a list posted today on Twitter, which I haven't verified, but based on the general tenor of the news, it's probably close to being true, of countries that are having civil unrest now, mostly derived from rising food and energy prices. And it's 28 countries long. You know, there is stuff going on out there all over the world. So what just happened in Sri Lanka, where the government basically fell? By the way, look up some of the images from that regime change protest. And it looks like there's a million people. You know, the streets are jammed to the horizon in the images, just as they're taking over the presidential palace. But apparently something similar, but not quite as far along, is happening in a lot of other countries. And that's going to be globally destabilizing if it continues in this direction, because a lot of these emerging markets, yes, they consume imported food and energy, and that's driving up their costs, but they also produce a lot of raw materials that get sold into the global marketplace. And if their government collapses and they're in chaos and it takes years to get back up to speed at whatever they were doing, that adds to the whole broken supply chain story, makes things even more complicated for everybody else, and drives up prices of a lot of things going forward. So this is kind of a feedback loop. In other words, trouble in the dominant economies become crises in the emerging markets, which make things even harder for the dominant economies. So there doesn't seem to really be an obvious end to any of this. You know, it just kind of has to play out. And if that's the case, we're really in just the first or second inning of the game, and a lot bigger headline grabbing trouble is in the near future.
Yeah, some good points, John. And I remember one time when I was down in the Bahamas visiting, and this guy told me if the U.S. gets a sniffle, the Bahamas gets a bad case of the cold. And it just goes to show that while we may have what we call first world problems in Canada, United States, some parts of Europe, although Europe's kind of a mess right now as well, it's really so much worse for emerging markets. Or imagine if you see the U.S. dollar skyrocketing up over 107 and some change now, almost to 107.80, that if you're an emerging market holding debt in U.S. dollars, it's catastrophic for you. And if you're just an average citizen of most countries and you can't afford food, shelter, energy costs to get around to get to your job, it can be not just a small nuisance, it can be disruptive for your entire life. So that's going to have ramifications worldwide. And I think sometimes we get so focused on what's happening in the U.S. markets or U.S. inflation, we lose sight of the global picture. But let's talk the U.S. markets for a second, John. The Fed is supposed to continue on their rate hiking cycle to fight this inflation. We've got a meeting, I think, next week where everybody's consensus is a 75 basis point hike. But are you in the camp that they're going to be able to keep hiking these rates higher and higher with their huge debt service load? Or is there a point where they're going to reach a tipping point and maybe have to scale back their initiatives?
Well, you know, given what's going on in the world, this might even be the end right now. You know, it's completely possible that we don't get any more Fed rate increases just because the world is becoming so chaotic. And you mentioned the strong dollar. That's a very big part of the story, because the dollar is hitting near record levels as against a lot of other currencies. And it's not so much what we're doing. You know, we're raising interest rates very modestly, and we've barely started quantitative tightening. In other words, the Fed selling assets instead of buying assets and shrinking the money supply in the process. That's really early in what could be a protracted process if things don't change. But what that's doing is it's affecting other countries who are not tightening yet. Japan and Europe, for instance, have not really started tightening. And the discrepancy between interest rates going up in the US and interest rates not rising in most of Europe and Japan is causing their currencies to tank, which is inflationary for them. Basically, we're exporting our inflation to these other countries. And that is making it harder and harder for them to maintain extremely low interest rates in the face of crashing currencies. So, you know, you're seeing the euro at parity with the US dollar now, which it hasn't been for over 20 years. And the Japanese yen is something like 135 to the dollar now, which 100 used to be the normal level. So these countries are suddenly in much worse shape than the US is. And they're liable to be the kind of leading edge of what comes next, where things start to break down in the developed world. So it's liable to be maybe Japan first and then Europe before it comes back to hit the US and Canada. So we might be kind of late in the game in terms of systemic collapse, but we're going to see some other big, previously unassailable entities go first.
Well, John, just thinking about Europe, one of the first things that comes to my mind is the energy crisis that they are in over there. And really, this was already an issue before the Ukraine-Russia situation escalated. Now it's an even bigger issue. The sanctions definitely didn't seem to slow Russia down much, but they certainly hurt Europe. And I would argue they've hurt almost all the other nations in NATO that were behind those, because now everybody's got high prices and Russia is selling their oil and gas, and they're still getting it out of the country for a lot better deal. And same thing with their base metals prices. So when you look at Europe and you look at the pickle they're in, the U.S. is now exporting liquid natural gas to Europe, and their energy prices, their natural gas prices are soaring. What would it mean if there was a protracted recession or depression in Europe for the rest of the world?
Well, this is a good example of how stupid the people running the system are. Because look at what they did. Europe contracted with Russia to build pipelines and ship natural gas from Russia to Europe, to the point where Europe became very dependent on Russian natural gas. Then NATO, which is a military organization run by the US, but also including Europe, continued to expand right up to the Russian border, even though Russia said, you know what, we want defensible borders, and what you're doing is an act of war. We're not going to let it happen. And Russia finally responds to that in the Ukraine. Then the idiots in charge of NATO decide to levy sanctions on Russia without thinking, apparently, that they need Russian gas in order not to freeze in this coming winter. And so what you would expect to happen is now happening. They're not getting nearly as much gas from Russia as they contracted for and they need. And Germany, of all places, is now rationing energy. They're cutting off the air conditioning at certain times and hot water at other times. And they're in a full-fledged energy crisis right now that is probably worse in terms of the impact on them than our oil crisis of the 1970s, which, you know, left a lot of scars that we still remember, those of us that lived through it. And that's Germany. That's what most people used to consider to be the best run society on earth. And they're in, you know, a major crisis right now, and it's a crisis of their own creation. Each step they took over the past decade or so brought them to this point. Remember, the U.S. tried to talk Europe out of those pipelines, out of becoming so dependent on Russian gas. But Europe loved those cheap prices and, you know, the guaranteed deliveries and everything, and they didn't listen. And then, you know, we didn't have to pick a fight with Russia. We didn't have to levy sanctions on them, but they did all those things. And now they're kind of reaping the whirlwind over there. And the other thing about Germany right now that's shocking is that they're not running a trade surplus anymore. They used to run this massive trade surplus year after year, which is one of the reasons that the euro was a half decent currency, because it was backed by Germany, which had a massive trade surplus. Well, that's all gone. And it's not clear how Europe gets out of any of this, because they're actually talking about the possibility of a total cutoff of Russian gas this winter or later in the summer, which bleeds over into the winter. And they have no solution to it. They have no way to get enough energy to run their economy if that's what happens. And they've kind of brought that about. So, yeah, these are weird, kind of out of the blue crises that in retrospect were completely self-inflicted. And there appears to be no easy fix for any of them.
Well, John, I would just layer on one more layer of lunacy, and that is after the Fukushima Daiichi plant issue, when there was that earthquake and tsunami in Japan, Japan shut down a lot of its nuclear reactors, and then there was public pushback against nuclear energy. They didn't bring a lot of them back on. They're in the same thing. They've got rolling blackouts. They've got power outages. They've got situations where the power has to be rationed. Well, so did Germany. After that, Germany did the exact same thing, and ironically, they were negative on uranium and nuclear power, but they were buying nuclear power from their neighbors in France, who was producing nuclear power, and they just started importing it, which caused all of their citizens' power bills to go higher. And then they started bringing in dirty coal, and they still had to bring in fossil fuels, but they're just paying a lot more for it. So these are terrible energy policies that a lot of nations have put in place, and we can't look too far afield, because here in the United States, the very first thing the Biden administration did was kill the Keystone Pipeline with the stroke of a pen. And there was talks about blocking another pipeline that went up through the Midwest. And we need that heavier oil down at our facilities to produce things like diesel and to produce things like jet fuel, which is shutting down our trucking fleets. The inability to get DEF, the inability to get diesel, is causing shipping problems and supply chain problems that are exacerbated by bad energy policies. So do you see this trend changing anytime soon? Will there be any sanity return to the mix where people realize we're really not done with fossil fuels yet?
Well, you can't really fix this in the short run because, for instance, if you want more refining capacity, you don't just go somewhere and flick a switch and you've got more refining capacity. You have to find some land where people will let you build a refinery and then go through all the permitting, et cetera, processes, and then build the thing in, 5 years maybe before that's ready. And that's maybe on the optimistic side in today's world. So none of this gets fixed right away. Like the Russia-Ukraine war can end tomorrow, and we're still left with the legacy of some really short-sighted, really strange energy policies. Oh, and it turns out that Biden went over to Saudi Arabia and OPEC Plus to beg for more oil not too long ago. And it turns out that the world's idea of the amount of extra capacity that those countries have was wildly overinflated. And Saudi Arabia literally does not have the extra capacity to get us out of our current mess. In other words, to pump enough oil to take care of the shortage that the world is suffering. So there really isn't an obvious fix to any of this. It's just a lot of bad decisions. In energy, as with monetary policy, years and years of bad decisions are finally coming back to haunt us. And there's no immediate fix for any of this stuff. You can't fix monetary policy with a few 50 basis point increases in the Fed funds rate. Much more has to be done. And you can't fix the energy problem with, a few more windmills or a couple extra fracking fields being opened or something like that. The problems are vastly bigger than the obvious solutions right now. So this goes on for a long time. Now, on the bright side, the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, North America, in other words, is closer to energy self-sufficiency than most other places. So, if we just stopped exporting stuff we were producing, we'd basically be okay. And there would still be an imbalance between the capacity to refine oil and gas into the things that we need, but it wouldn't be existentially threatening the way it is for Europe and Japan. But we still have a mess on our hands regardless. It's just, as with monetary policy, it maybe is not as big a mess as some other countries, but criticizing Japan or Europe or whoever else shouldn't be seen as cheerleading for the U.S. We're a huge mess, too. It's just that a few other places are maybe in somewhat bigger messes right now than we are.
Absolutely, John. We've got our fair share of woes here in North America, whether it's Canada or the United States. And while we have the capacity to be energy independent, I mean, let's just remember that the current administration ran on the idea of putting out of business the oil and gas industry, and now they want them to drill, baby, drill, and pump, baby, pump. And there's been a decade of underinvestment into the oil and gas space, where banks were discouraged from lending, where funds were discouraged from holding oil and gas companies, where it's only a very tiny makeup of the S&P or NASDAQ or Dow. There's very few energy companies still in the mix. So it's ironic that everybody that ran on the dream of electric vehicles and we're going to have charging points in every corner, we're nowhere close to that. But we also are getting closer and closer to what some are worried could be a recessionary period, where GDP Now in Atlanta has just put out their forecast for the second quarter, and they believe it will be yet another second negative quarter of GDP growth. Is it possible that if we did invest in charging stations and really ramping up copper and nickel mining and getting batteries going, that that could be something that could save us? Could the energy crisis turn out to be something that could actually be a boon for North America, whether Canada or the United States?
Well, not in the short run, because it takes so long to actually do anything in that space. Longer term, this will all balance out. You know, evolving industries always have periods of glut and shortage. And, you know, you go through these mini crises. That's what happens. Look at semiconductors, for instance. It's a growing field, has been for four decades now. But you have these booms and busts because it's hard to get supply and demand perfectly in balance over long periods of time. And it's going to be that way in energy as we continue the transition to renewables. Okay, that's still going to happen, although it doesn't feel like it right now. But in the meantime, yeah, you got this challenge with fossil fuels of saying, okay, well, you know, we're going to transition out of these things over the next 20 or 30 years. You know, the mistake is to say we're going to do it in 5 years, which is impossible. But still, you still want the people working in the field to continue to invest so that the supply of the thing you're trying to transition out of doesn't dry up prematurely. By the way, that's the same thing happening in the trucking industry. You know, a few years ago, self-driving trucks were going to take over the industry, you know, and in 10 years, there were going to be no truck drivers or anything. So now, surprise, surprise, the trucking industry can't get drivers because nobody wants to go through all the training only to be made obsolete by self-driving trucks in 2 or 3 years or whatever. Well, we've got a lot of industries where stuff like that is happening. You know, it's a transition from one thing to another, but it's not an abrupt one. It's a gradual one in which you have to maintain balance the whole way through. And energy is a big one where it's highly unlikely that the problems we have now can be fixed in the coming year. You know, there's just not enough time to do it.
Yeah, John, it's often the policies and the messaging from political parties, as well as the media that feeds these narratives, that often are their own worst enemies. It comes back to bite them. And we've seen that play out in energy, but we've also seen that play out in inflation. And this week, we're awaiting the CPI number and the PPI number, the producer price index, as well as the consumer price index. Most people expect inflation to be persistently high. And it's really not just affecting energy and food, although those are primary. It's affecting every area of life. And there doesn't have to be a supply chain issue to see the cost of your lawn service go up, or nursing care service go up, or movie tickets go up. It's affecting everywhere. And it's because there's too much liquidity that's been sloshing around the system, really, for the last few decades. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. So the Fed is pedaling like crazy, and so are other central banks, to try to get on top of this inflation. But John, even if we see the numbers start trending a little bit lower, the prices are so much higher than they were just a few years ago. Is there anything anybody can do, not just the Fed or government stimulus, is there anything that can be done to put Humpty Dumpty back together again?
Well, you know, inflation is going to be an interesting story going forward, because we're seeing a lot of demand destruction now, which is to say when interest rates go up or the world gets dicey for whatever other reason, people stop buying stuff and the demand therefore goes down, and that pulls prices down. And we're seeing that with houses now, where at least in the U.S., people are starting to cut their asking prices pretty aggressively. And we're seeing it in cars, where car prices just went through the roof in the last few years. And they're starting to roll over and come back down now. And a lot of these big car mortgages are starting to default. People took out insane car loans and now they can't pay them. And so you could easily see house prices and car prices start to go down in the next year, which would be deflationary. In other words, it would detract from our inflation numbers. So it's not clear how much longer the current rate of inflation stays with us, but when it goes down, it's going to be going down because of bad reasons, not because we're getting healthy and there's plenty of supply and stuff like that. It's because people run out of money because of high prices and they can't buy the stuff they used to buy. Therefore, demand is going down. Therefore, prices are falling. That's, in other words, it's a recession. And it's highly likely that we have some, you know, maybe just a technical recession for a little while before we fall off the cliff, or maybe we immediately fall off a cliff and everything changes. But the global growth is going to slow dramatically in the next couple of years as central banks either tighten or don't ease further, and people run out of money. That's just how it is, you know, and you're not going to see, for instance, Germany stay out of recession when they're completely out of natural gas and they're turning people's, oh, you know what else they have in Germany? They're setting up like shelters where they take over a gymnasium and have a bunch of little cubicles in there, which they heat. So if your apartment is freezing, you can go to this cubicle and spend 2 hours to get warmed up before you go back out into the cold. So anyhow, that's not a strongly growing economy when you see stuff like that. It's not a sign of health. And that's the world that we're heading into. So the numbers that we see now are very ominous, but we could easily be seeing a different kind, but equally ominous set of numbers in 6 months to a year.
Yeah, John, and you see the tug of war out there in the financial media of like, are we going into recession? Are those fears overblown? We saw a good job number just last week and people said, see, the fears of a recession overblown. But again, we saw two negative quarters in a row of GDP growth. We're also seeing a lot of companies shedding workers. We're starting to see the unemployment start up. We're also seeing the amount of weekly jobless claims have been increasing the last 4 months in a row. And they're getting near that point where it could be a tipping point. And so it seems like all of the ingredients of stagflation are already upon us and have been. We've got high energy prices. We've got racing inflation. We've got stagnating growth. We've got unemployment ratcheting up. Yet all we hear in the media is the strength of the consumer. Look how strong the consumers are. I mean, I see consumer confidence levels and they're down in the toilet. So I don't know where the strength of the consumer is coming from. And we keep hearing reports of people living off credit cards, refinancing their home to live off that, or dipping all the way through their savings. So there's got to be a breaking point where this is going to hit the retail companies, the service companies. At what point do these start showing up in earnings reports when we look at these big companies and their future growth prospects?
Well, yeah. Okay, corporate profit margins will also be a big story going forward because they're being hit twice. One is the cost of a lot of their imports, including labor. You know, they're having to pay up to get good people, and the cost of the stuff that they use to make things, that's all way up. At the same time that consumers, first of all, they spent their stimmy checks during the COVID lockdowns. And then they started maxing out their credit cards to maintain that lifestyle, and to the point where available credit is shriveling up now. So now people are stuck. Until they get some new government program to increase their incomes, they are mostly going to have to cut back on their buying. So companies are going to see falling sales and rising costs at the same time. So the next couple of earnings report seasons could be pretty dismal. And that's a problem for the stock market because corporate earnings underpin share prices. And if earnings are going down, then other things being equal, stock prices ought to go down too, which in turn slows down the economy, which causes people to pull back on their spending even further. And you get this kind of death spiral into a recession, which could turn into something much more serious. Because any kind of a crisis or a downturn now carries the risk of it being the first domino of many and just causing some much bigger crisis than it would normally. You know, it used to be a 20% drop in stock prices barely affected the economy at all overall, but now it's an existential threat. So falling corporate profits could be a big component of this feedback loop that we see in the next couple of years that take us to a very dark place.
John, just as we wrap up, I mean, the next question for people would be, okay, we've got a world in chaos. We've got pressure on the economy. We will have pressure on the markets. We've got pressure on the consumers. It's not just a U.S. thing. It's a global thing. Where do investors go to shelter themselves from the storm? Because we haven't really seen gold and silver. They've held up okay, all things considered, but they haven't been ratcheting higher, and bonds have been, you know, decimated over the last 2 years. Where can investors go to ride out the storm? Is it just the U.S. dollar that everybody's going to crowd into, or are there other options that people have?
Well, there aren't a lot of places to hide out. If we're heading for another 2008 or early 2020 crash, because those things pulled down everything. There was virtually nothing you could buy, no investment that you could buy that would do well in terms of equities, anything risk on, you know, equities or real estate or whatever, they all tanked. And back then, you did have long-term government bonds that did well. But now we're in an inflationary environment, which is very bad for bonds. So it's not clear where you hide out. I would say cash is not about, and you've probably noticed the network shutdowns in Australia and Canada lately, where all of a sudden you couldn't access your bank account or anything for a while. Add those things in, and maybe this is not a bad time to pull some money out of your bank account and just have some extra cash at home. Now, taking this one step further, though, there become all kinds of things you can buy, because when things get really chaotic, and we're not far from that point, the central banks of the world are going to have to pivot back to easing. In other words, they'll capitulate on this whole tightening thing. And they'll start cutting interest rates. And, you know, the U.S. will see negative interest rates this time around. And Europe and Japan will see more than negative interest rates, much deeper negative interest rates. And that's a great environment for precious metals. So this would be a time to put in lowball bids for instance, gold mining stocks. Not a time to jump with both feet into them, because it's completely possible that we're going to see a kind of a falling off the cliff of share prices, or a spike of, you know, one last gasp spike of inflation that really hurts bonds or something like that. Some kind of a chaotic market event. And that might not be good for gold and silver in the short run. But further down the road, central banks are going to have to react to this. And they'll react with extremely easy money. And people will conclude probably that this is it. Central banks can never tighten again, because look, they had to ease in the face of 8% inflation. And so that's the kind of environment where you want things that are safe havens, inflation hedges, things like that. And gold and silver will tend to do really, really well in that kind of a situation. So I don't think we're that far from that point. Hence the low ball bid idea, you know, put some bids in for things at 10 or 15 or 20% lower than they are. And in that kind of downward capitulation spasm that we might get, you might get hit at some really attractive prices. But do not bet the rent money on any of this stuff. You know, your general, heading into a time of chaos, your general attitude ought to be really cautious. And that means pay off debt, hold a little more than usual cash on hand, and don't take big chances, because the opportunities are at the bottom. When the Fed finally starts to capitulate and all the other central banks follow suit. We're not there yet, but we may not be that far away.
Well, some definite ideas for people to mull over in their own lives as far as what kind of a defensive posture they'd like to take. But I think you're right. Having a large amount of cash right now is helpful. Not betting the rent money, especially if the rent may be going up, John. So we want to make sure people have a safety net. But typically, precious metals do well in that kind of environment if the Fed was to reverse course. We'll have to wait and see. It seems like that they are blazing forward with their rate hiking cycle, at least in the short term. How much longer that will last remains to be seen. But until then, we'll keep following along with these wild markets. Always like getting your thoughts, John. And for those that like getting John's thoughts or some of the different information his site curates, check out the dollarcollapse.com website down below. Thanks so much, John, for sharing some time with us here at the KE Report.
Thanks, Chad.